This is Spotlight Health on Aspen Public Radio, our six-part series partnering with the Aspen Ideas Festival and the Spotlight Health Conference. Each week, we bring you conversations with an exceptional mix of inspiring and provocative experts who dive into topics of global and domestic health.
Good afternoon, I'm Allison Bektesh, and this is Spotlight Health. Thanks for tuning in. We humans spend a lot of time and resources protecting our own health, but how much impact does that have if we're not also looking out for the health of the planet we live on? Peggy Clark is a co-producer of the Spotlight Health Conference, celebrating its fifth year this June. She explains how the well-being of the planet is vital to human health.
We are all experiencing these huge, huge variations in climate and weather, and the place, sort of the canary in the coal mine, is people's health. So the intersection between what's happening in the environment and what's happening in human health is the place where we're seeing most clearly what are some of the very serious problems that we're going to have to solve for. So, you know, the most obvious ones are pollution and asthma in children, for example, that are growing up in communities that have high levels of pollution. But fertility rates, the relationship between toxic chemicals and, you know, serious declines in fertility rates, bringing forward some research on that. Also, in terms of what we mean by our climate, our health, there's a whole field of study where researchers are exactly looking and sort of tracking how these changes in weather are influencing disease patterns. And it's pretty profound globally and actually very worrisome. And it's not really that surprising when you think about the level of droughts or the level of flooding and the kind of things that are happening with more severity. But if you zoom out to a planetary perspective, you see that we are becoming, on a health front, ever more vulnerable to what's happening with our planet. And so there's a direct relationship between health and our environment.
You are listening to Spotlight Health 2018, Episode 3, Our Planet, Our Health. Melanie Chukas Bradley grew up finding inspiration from the wonders of the natural world she encountered as soon as she opened her door in Vermont.
I just grew up wandering in the woods from a very young age and, you know, looking for wildflowers as soon as the snow had melted, drinking icy sap from the maple sap buckets lining our dirt road, climbing the trees.
Now Chukas Bradley shares that same wonder with the office dwellers of Washington, D.C. as a certified nature and forest therapy guide, leading urban hikes and encouraging appreciation for all the sensations the outdoor world has to offer, a stress-reducing technique known as forest bathing.
A forest therapy walk is different from a hike. It's like those moments on your hike when you stop and you take in the view with a sense of awe, or you come upon a patch of wildflowers and you stop and just enjoy the beauty. You know, on any hike you have those moments, and on a forest therapy walk, you really, you know, it's really made up of those moments. It's just made up of those moments of feeling your connection to the beauty and wonder around you and being very quiet. So it's a really enjoyable practice.
Shouldn't it be most natural to want to be outside? Like, why do we have to be so intentional about it?
Yes, that is a very good question, and I've given that a lot of thought. I think that the things that we do indoors have become so compelling for us. You know, having everything right at our fingertips at all times, the ability to contact anyone we want to contact, to hear the latest headlines. We're very engaged, you know, with electronics and with our work, and we all work really hard, you know, and we all have our to-do lists, and it's hard to let that go. It's hard to prioritize something that is, you know, it's not quantifiable. We have to tell ourselves that it's important, and once you're out in the woods, there's just no question that it was the thing to do. When I go and sit, I have a rock that I sit on that's in the middle of Rock Creek, and I go and sit on that rock whenever I can, and I never consider that wasted time. because it's so restorative. I feel such joy when I'm sitting there and I see the wood ducks paddling past and I see a great blue heron standing in the shallows fishing and I hear the birds and I see the trees in bloom. That does never feel like wasted time. But, you know, when you're very busy and you've got a lot to do, it's hard to do something that doesn't feel like it's, you know, accomplishing your goals of the day.
Is there something that you recommend if I find my place and sit under my tree, then is there a procedure to make sure can you do it right or wrong?
Yeah, well, you can't do it wrong. There's no there's no wrong way. But we do have, you know, there are certain things that have been shown to really be beneficial. And one of them is deep breathing, deep, slow breathing, where you take the air in and you just let your belly gently rise as you breathe in and then breathe out. And then pay attention to what you're noticing. Pay attention to... on our guided walks, we will give people a series of invitations. And our first invitation is usually to feel the pleasures of presence. So just feel how good it feels to be where you are, to be breathing the air, to be seeing the leaves move in the breeze, to hear the birds, to watch the clouds. Just whatever you're experiencing, let it in and really enjoy it. And then we will often give, as a second invitation, asking people to notice what's in motion. And that can be a really powerful thing. It sounds so simple, but once you tune in to the way the leaves are just gently blowing in the breeze, you may see a caterpillar crawling across the path, watch a spider building a web, just very simple motion around you. Once you tune into that, you really begin to relax and feel like you're part of your surroundings. And then you can, tune in to the sounds around you. You know, pay attention to the sounds that are close to you and the sounds that are far away. Really tune into them. Any kind of smells, you know, plants have all sorts of delightful smells. Mm. And when you smell not just the flowers, but the leaves and the twigs and the bark and the soil, all of those smells are good for you. They're good for your immune system. They make you feel good. Communing with a tree is always a powerful thing in any way that feels comfortable to you. You know, some people are comfortable talking to trees and listening to trees. Some people just like to sit quietly under them or climb into them or just lie on their backs and look up into the branches. When I was in Japan with a small group of North American guides on a forest bathing trip in the fall of 2017, our Shinrin-yoku guides in Japan up in the Japanese Alps and in woodlands near Tokyo would give us mats to lie on and just invite us to lie under the trees and look up into the branches. And that's just a very powerful thing to do. And, you know, the main thing is really just to slow down, tune in, and breathe deeply.
Even hearing the descriptions of some of these things is calming me down. I mean, I think there's something so innate that connects you to, like, the visual of a caterpillar. Like, yeah, then it's not just me in the world. Like, there's all this life, and there's something so calming about that.
It's so calming, and it's so miraculous. You know, when you think of the biodiversity on Earth and just all of the beautiful life forms, when you take the time to slow down and just tune into them, it's a very powerful experience.
Melanie Chukas Bradley is a certified nature and forest therapy guide. Her newest book, The Joy of Forest Bathing, comes out in September. Thank you so much for your time today, Melanie.
Thank you so much, Allison. It was such a pleasure talking with you today.
You are listening to Spotlight Health on Aspen Public Radio. In this six-part series, we take a look inside the individual tracks of the Spotlight Health Conference from the Aspen Institute in Aspen, June 21st through 24th. Today, we hear from speakers from the track Our Planet, Our Health. Back with more in a moment. Greg Trinish is a wildlife biologist and avid outdoorsman. He's the founder and executive director of the aptly named Adventure Scientists.
We're a nonprofit that really is a global network of volunteers. We've got people all over the world who love the outdoors and come to us looking for ways that they can make a difference with their time outside. And so our job at Adventure Scientists is really to find projects that we really feel confident have a great opportunity to yield lasting results and deploy this group of amazing volunteers on those projects.
This term environmental health, what does it really mean and how does it relate to human health?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So environmental health and human health are inseparable from one another. The healthy environment, you know, obviously there's going to be different tiers of what that means. I think there's obviously a spectrum from your most pristine ecosystems, which are absolutely still going to be impacted by humans at this point. You know, we have carbon in our atmosphere in levels that we haven't seen in an awfully long time, millions and millions of years. And we've got an environment that is absolutely impacted. That being said, there are places left on the planet, places like the Okavango Delta, places that are remote and exciting and that are still pristine by all accounts. And so it's a spectrum, but environmental health is a healthy planet with clean water and clean air and happy plants and trees and animals and ecosystems that enable nature to thrive, which in turn enables us to thrive.
Do you have projects that have already gone from concept to completion?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have done more than 130 of these projects to date. And, you know, those range from we worked on this awesome project out on the Olympic National Forest in Washington, where our job was to put out camera traps, baited camera stations. So we actually took beaver carcasses and nailed them to trees, put a cage up around them, and then had camera traps running 24/7. And there were 40 or 50 traps that we set across that eastern side of that national forest. And the whole purpose was to search for the Olympic coastal marten. And that marten hadn't been seen there in years and years and years. And from the project that we did in partnership with an amazing biologist named Betsy Howell at the Forest Service, we were able to show that they just weren't in that area. And that led to them getting listed as critically imperiled. That led to millions of dollars of new research investment being poured into them and into the area, and ultimately will lead to the reemergence of the Olympic coastal marten in the Olympic Peninsula. We had a great project that we're just now about to enter phase two on, but it was our challenge was to go out and collect scat samples from as many different taxa and as many different places as we could all around the globe and send those off to Harvard Medical School, where they work to isolate the genes that are responsible for antibiotic resistance in Enterococcus, which is the most prolific and one of the oldest bacteria on the planet. And because it is so old and so prolific, our scientific partners believe that it likely has the origins of antibiotic resistance, not just for Enterococcus, but that it was transferred to other bacteria as well. And so to hear our partner, Mike Gilmore, explain this is like one of the greatest gifts of my life, is to listen to him talk about these kelp forests of bacteria waving in this ether and of fluid and have bacteria floating through them with their flagella and shooting serums at each other and putting up force fields. And it's like this incredible warfare that's happening right under our noses. And what's so amazing about bacteria is that when they utilize antibiotic resistance, or when it's actually penetrated by another bacteria, if you destroy the first bacteria, you can take on the traits of that bacteria. You can take on their genes and you can actually take on the characteristics of that first bacteria by basically consuming or encompassing their genes. It's just this like crazy zombie-like world that's happening all around us. And it's allowed antibiotic resistance to be transferred from bacteria. And so we're working to really get to the core of which genes are actually responsible for antibiotic resistance. And we've already narrowed the search, or our partners have already narrowed that search from the thousands and thousands of potential genes that it could be, down to just 126 genes that could potentially be responsible for enterococcus resistant antibiotic resistance.
I can hear the passion in your voice, and I also think it's so fascinating.
Yeah, it's so amazing. And I get to like geek out with Harvard researchers, and we did an amazing project out on the Slocum Arm of Southeast Alaska with a Stanford researcher named Lauren Oakes, who's since joined our advisory council, focused on the die-off of yellow cedar trees. And we've worked collecting the highest known plant life on Earth from Mount Everest and other peaks around the world. And we're actually working to reinvigorate that project now, which will ultimately yield our ability to grow crops in extreme environments, in drought-rich environments and frost-rich environments, in these extreme environments around the world. And having more robust or faster-growing crops that have higher yields will ensure that we don't have to encroach on habitat nearly as quickly as we otherwise would.
You yourself are also just a backcountry guy, an adventurer, and I think that is going to be very common among the audience here in Aspen and our listeners. What can the outdoor community do to help out or be part of that environmental health solution?
Yeah, it's a great question. I do come from an adventure background primarily. I spent years of my life out as a National Geographic explorer. I still get to take amazing expeditions all the time. And for me, I constantly felt when I was out there, whether on the Appalachian Trail or down a trek I did in the Andes, I constantly felt like I was just not fulfilled in those pursuits. Like I wanted to be doing something beneficial at the same time that I was out there. And that's really what led me to start Adventure Scientists, was this deep, deep desire to make sure that I was using my outdoor skill set to make a difference. And I think anybody who cares about the places that they get to play has an opportunity through our organization, through some many other great organizations out there, to participate. And that means that you could be building trails. That means that you could be learning about these areas and sharing a passion for them. And that means that you could come and collect scientific data to really help address global environmental issues through our organization. But I hope that you'll get involved in some way. We need everyone involved in the conversation, and there's a lot of different ways you can get involved that will really speak to you. But apathy or just assuming somebody else is going to do it isn't going to work. It's not working and it hasn't worked. So get involved.
Greg Trinish is the founder and executive director of Adventure Scientists. He will be speaking at Spotlight Health in June. Greg, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Spotlight Health on Aspen Public Radio, a partnership with the Aspen Ideas Festival and the Spotlight Health Conference, which celebrates its fifth year this summer. Our six-week series takes you inside the discussions and discoveries leading up to the conference. We'll be right back. DeSalvo is a professor of medicine and population health at University of Texas at Austin Dell Medical School. During the Obama administration, she served as acting assistant secretary for health and national coordinator for health information technology at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Prior to that, she was New Orleans health commissioner. She stepped into that role after her own experiences during Hurricane Katrina. When we think of the environment or the planet and how that might affect our health, are we as citizens helpless? Do we either live in a place with bad air quality or not? Do we either get involved in one of these destructive storms or not? What can humans do when they're relating to the planet for their own health?
You know, the big lessons that we have begun to learn and implement, particularly in the healthcare and public health world, is that some, first of all, disasters, particularly those that are related to climate change, are happening more often and impacting people in geographies where we tend to cluster, the coastlines as an example. And so though Louisiana was, you know, certainly from Katrina, one of the early lessons that where we saw the significant impact of things like flooding, we've now over the course of the last dozen years as a country had so many additional challenges. For example, Superstorm Sandy or the hurricane season last summer that was so devastating to places like Puerto Rico and Texas and Florida. And so the learning that this is going to be a part of life also means that we have to act as humans to think about hardening our infrastructure and making sure that our communities are prepared and resilient so that when storms or disasters or power outages happen, we have some system redundancy that can not only make sure that the physical infrastructure is hardened and ready because it's got backup power as an example, but that the people in the community also are as strong and ready as they can be and can bounce back more quickly.
It really touches me that you were actually there when Katrina hit and then later went on as health commissioner to be part of the solution. For that personal experience while you were undergoing that, were you thinking from the mind of a health practitioner or were you just you trying to make it work for you?
You know, it's interesting. In the face of a catastrophe like that, there's a lot of chaos, but very quickly I had the idea that my work was going to be in that community, helping her come back, helping her people stand up again. And there were a lot of other folks who had that same mindset. But I think the key issue for us was that very early after the waters began to recede, so about 2 weeks later, we began to talk about and write about the fact that we needed to not build back what we had, but that we needed to build a health system that was going to generate health for our community. We had some of the worst health outcomes in the nation, and in fact, the world, in the community of New Orleans. And as a doctor, I saw that every day in clinic. People coming in with kidney disease from their diabetes or with complications of infectious infections like heart valve infections, things that honestly are entirely preventable if you move upstream and create a healthcare system that's got more primary care in it and give people more access. But also if you go further upstream and create healthy communities where there's green space and sidewalks for walking, clean air and social relationships that you have strengthened things like your faith-based community or community organizations that are looking out for neighbors. And so those were all the things that we thought about right away after the storm, that we were not going to go back. I say sometimes that it was like an epigenetic phenomena for me. I mean, I was a doctor and a researcher and a health system leader, but the change that happened for me in those days after the storm was this realization that as awful as the storm was, as catastrophic as it was, this was an opportunity for us to do better by the people in our community, and those people were my patients. And so my work literally on the streets was about patient care, but also always thinking about creating a system that would support them and the health professionals and the partners that we had to generate better health. And it's what continued to draw me to public health, really, Allison. It was the motivation for me to serve the public in a way that was different than being a doctor in the community or building healthcare. It was a way to really think about all the determinants of health that affect people's health more than the healthcare system that account for about 60% of health, and see that we had a more resilient community for them in the event that any disaster happened to them, small every day or big like a Hurricane Katrina.
You said, as devastating as it was, one thing that came out of Hurricane Katrina was learning how to better prepare our towns for a natural disaster like this. What is being done differently, either there or our nation worldwide? What did we learn?
One of the things that we learned was that as we work on preparedness for any kind of a disaster, it has to be all hazard. So we have to be thinking about the fact that it's not just going to be a hurricane or it's not just going to be a tornado. There are power outages, there are floods. We call that an all hazards approach. And we actually, as a country, created new infrastructure, new expectations around communication for first responders that have frankly led to lives being saved. And you can see that kind of work in action in disasters today, where there's a more rapid response and more resources are brought to bear. It doesn't always work as well. I mean, I think we saw in Puerto Rico that it didn't, that the systems were overwhelmed, but certainly in places like Texas or Florida in the most recent hurricane season, we saw that that national preparedness system that's essentially evolved since a dozen years ago at the time out of the lessons learned from Katrina is really working better. I think the second big thing is about building buildings more strongly. So raising up your air conditioning units, having a water system that's separate and apart from the city system, a cistern, so that you can keep the hospitals going, having redundant information technology or energy infrastructure so you don't lose the important clinical data, not only for the hospital, but as people evacuate. So we've hardened the healthcare systems, and they're able to shelter in place for a longer period of time and not get in so much trouble. People who remember Katrina and remember all the suffering that people went through in those hospitals, and we've made some good progress there. There's still more work to do in places like nursing homes. And I think the last piece that is working better is this idea of resilient communities. So when we used to do preparedness and response, we did just those two parts. We'd rush in, we'd kind of get ready for the disaster, we'd rush in and pull people out of the houses, and then the response would end. We're realizing now that you can't stop there. There's a recovery period to make sure people, for example, get back in their houses, but there's also the in-between period to make sure that their housing stock is safe and not exacerbating things like asthma, or that they have better quality of life in between. So in the event that there's another disaster type occurrence, they're stronger, the community and the individuals walking into it. So it's definitely been about creating more infrastructure that can respond to disasters by hardening the healthcare infrastructure so it can support people when needed. But at the end of the day, it's also about really creating more strong and resilient communities. And we've been able to do all of those things in New Orleans, though I'm perhaps most excited that these things have spread across the country and that more people are protected as a result.
Karen DeSalvo is a professor of medicine and population health at University of Texas Austin Dell Medical School. She's also the former health commissioner for the city of New Orleans, though she was not in that position during Katrina. Karen, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks for tuning in to Spotlight Health 2018, Episode 3, Our Planet, Our Health. Tune in next week as we look into another Spotlight Health conference track, Healthy Communities. From efforts to end sex trafficking in Uganda and growing fresh produce in Detroit, what are communities doing worldwide to directly impact the health of their own neighborhoods? To get caught up on past episodes while you wait, go online, aspenpublicradio.org. I'm Allison Bektesh. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Spotlight Health, a partnership with the Aspen Ideas Festival and the Spotlight Health Conference. Join us Tuesdays at 3:30 for conversations with featured speakers from the 2018 festival. Hear from leaders in medical research, patient care, and others on the forefront of health. You can also listen to this series online at aspenpublicradio.org. The 2018 conference runs from June 21st through 24th and features five program tracks: The Cutting Edge of Medicine and Science, Healthy Communities, Disrupting Health Systems, Our Planet, Our Health, and Viewpoints. Spotlight Health is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.